Accession number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 9.
Mr. P. Armstrong, reel 9. You'd arrived at Brandsperth, the depot of the regiment, Mr. Armstrong, and were training new recruits, particularly those that were going as a draft to the battalions already in the field. Was the training exactly the same as what you'd already gone through?
Yes, the idea was the same. Of course, Brandsperth hadn't long become the depot. We'd moved from Newcastle, where we were brigade, where we were in depot with the Northumberland Fusiliers, and so the intake due to the war was too much and rather overwhelmed the services. So I and the officers that were with me, there were three of us for instance, we were billeted on houses in
Meadowfield, Willington.
Meadowfield. That's where we were, on the main road, and our chaps were billeted in the British Legion hut on the other side of the road further up. Still there. And rations were brought down round to us, so we didn't have a lot of contact with Brandsperth at the time, where they were desperately trying to make it into a proper camp in the fields behind. They were laying down the parade ground and huts and all the rest of it. Our training was done in the fields behind the Boyne Tell, and I pass there regularly now and think of those days, because it was heavy snow when I first started there, and the poor chaps were wet a lot of the time. However, it was urgent, we had to get done, we did all the training of the type that I have mentioned to you. Our trouble was that we weren't certain whether they would go as a body or whether they would just be frittered away to other battalions, the 6th, the 8th and the 9th, whether they would go to other companies, fed in piecemeal, or what was going to happen. So it didn't make training very easy. This went on until March.
What was the situation with regard to equipment? Were you well equipped?
No. No, most of the equipment had gone overseas. And we were training purely and simply as foot soldiers. We were training with rifle and bayonet regularly. We also had Bren guns to practice with, but otherwise, no, we had no other weapons. And unfortunately, we didn't even have signalling equipment. We were pretty badly off. But you could see everything was rushed over to France, and they were desperately trying to form a line, because, in my opinion, we had a good prepared position and could have stayed much longer than did happen, but the BEF at the time were battling to stabilise this position before anything happened from the German point of view.
The recruits that you were working with, where were they? What background did they have?
They were varied. Some were territorials who were back from, say, hospitals, courses, or various other reasons why they hadn't been called up. Some were reservists. Some very good reservists came to us, which were good forming a cadre. And we even had militiamen came to us there, because the depot of the Durhams then, people were being called up all over the country, And literally, I think in a lot of cases, it was a question of saying, you're from Durham, oh, go to the Durham Light Infantry. This happened, and I was very happy with the class of chap I had. They were good, they were keen, and anxious to get on with their training and get on with the job.
Did your unit have a title? The particular unit you were training, did it have a title? A name?
No, it was just the... Oh, yes, they did call it... I think they called themselves the First Infantry Training Depot. I think that was the name that they were originally called by, but we just knew it as the depot, being terms. With me at the time was a newly called up chap called Vane. His father was a Belgian, actually, who'd settled in England after the First War. He was training as a doctor, but as soon as the call of the war came, he gave that up, and being an ex-university training officer, he was commissioned into the Durhams, which was a little bit of a loss because he'd done 3 out of his 4 years. However, I found him an absolute marvel. He was extremely good. Every order he got, he carried out. Interesting little point. His mother asked me to call. She lived at Stockton. And when I called with her son, she asked me if I would look after him. He was about 4 inches and about 2 stone heavier than me, about 4 inches taller, a big tough chap. And I thought, this is some sort of a thing that mothers, only mothers, can ask. He was my special, I think he was put with me because it was his first appointment. We trained, as I say, until March. And then the signal came that I had to take a draft over to France. And I understood that we were going to reinforce the 6th. We were concentrated at a place, St. Margaret's Church Hall, which is not there now, at the top of Crossgate.
Durham City.
Durham City. The officers and the sergeant major were down at the bottom on the left, which is now also being pulled down, and Archibald's taken it over. And we were concentrated there for a matter of 3 days, and then one night, with a hurricane lamp at the front and a hurricane lamp at the rear, we marched down and up to the station.
What constituted the actual draft itself? You say there were self-officers and so on.
Now, at the time, from Bronsworth, I took, at the time, 60 men, which would have been the equivalent of 2 full platoons for myself and Mr. Vane. We got to the station and paraded, assembled on the platform, and being almost a year old in the army, I was supposed to be knowledgeable, and therefore when the train came in, I started packing them into the compartments, each carriage in turn. There's a drill for people, in training, if you wish. And when I got halfway along, I realised that Major Stobart from the depot had started from the other end and had started packing from there. So the middle of the train was a shambles. However, we got them all aboard. We pulled out of Durham, and I was told that there was another draft to be picked up at Darlington. So when we got to Darlington, I stepped out, and there was an officer standing by himself, looking terribly lonely. And I said to him, "Are you Whitehead?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "And where are your troops?" He said, well, I thought I would just let them go for a drink in the canteen. I said, you ABC? And I went to the canteen, opened the door and shouted, Durham's? And they all looked around and said, get out. And they shot out. And by that time, the station master was almost hysterical. And they were thrown into the train. We got away with a delay of minutes. However, when I walked along the train, because the duty of the officer is to see that his men are settled, whether it's on the train or whether it's on foot or whether it's in camp, I went along, couldn't find Mr. Whitehead, and in the guards compartment, there was a gentleman in silk pajamas on the camp bed, beautiful and comfortably and warm, and sound asleep. I'm ashamed to say I turned him over. Naturally, he was rather put out, and I told him very, very firmly that his duty was to see that his men were comfortable and had the best accommodation that was possible and not over packed in one compartment and so on. And he told me that he found it difficult to understand what they were telling him about the various people, and I couldn't think why until I realised he was from the very, very south country, and our men were literally all north countrymen. I hadn't realised they were all from the Durham and Chesley Street area. So the twang was pronounced, and he was baffled. I hope he learned quickly. Anyhow, we got to King's Cross, and I remember we were ferried across London and on another train with no problem at all. The RTO there were very, very good, and we were down in Dover in no time. No, beg your pardon, Portsmouth. We went to Portsmouth. We were in Portsmouth in no time at all, and from Portsmouth we went straight across to Cherbourg.
What was the size of your party by now?
90. But there was another officer, Tim McGoran, who had another party of 90. And when I spoke to him, the odd time I had to, he told me that he had been told exactly the same. He was going to take reinforcements, and he wasn't sure to whom. And he had three officers, or at least there were three officers in his group.
What date would this be?
Mid-March.
Do you remember much of the crossing, the journey itself?
The crossing, it was just as gentle and quiet as in peacetime. There was no problems, there was no zigzagging, there was no nonsense. We went across, there were more than our Durham troops, of course. We were just part of the, I would say myself that there would be something like 3,000 altogether coming up towards 3,000. It was certainly quite a party. And when we got to Cherbourg, we were looking over the side when we saw our first evidence of the French army. There were about half a dozen very, very scruffy people. The uniforms looked as though they'd been brought from a second-hand shop. They were leaning on the rifles, smoking a cigarette, hands in their pockets, and looked as though they hadn't a care or any interest in the world. And some of our chaps said, go, what on earth are we here for? We're not going to fight with them, are we? However,
what was your reception like when you landed in France?
At first, not a lot of interest. I imagine there'd been so many people through Cherbourg by that time that they weren't terribly interested. They were getting on with the job. the Germans hadn't made any move. It was all rather unreal. And we were marched from the boat to a train, the usual 8 chevaux and so on, and we were taken straight to Rouen, had to march about 2 or 3 miles from the train into this enormous camp. And the batman that Vane had acquired whilst we were in Durham said, "Good Lord, this is where I was demobilised in 1918.
Was this a hutted camp?
Tented. There were huts there, of course, for cooking and so on, but it was tented camp for us.
So you had men with you who were still First World War experienced?
Yes. More than 25. That was how I remember him. And he'd served in the Durhams in 1918. Of course, he'd been young then. He was regular. He'd served in India, and he'd been on reserve, and that's why he was called up with us. So that was our first comment.
How were the troops taken to the French? Were they getting on all right with them? Or?
By that time, they hadn't met any. We moved into this camp, and first thing we found was that the sanitation was left a lot to be desired, and so Vane was appointed sentryman, IC sentry orderlies. And he got down and made some civilised, because it was beginning to get warm even then.
What were the sanitary conditions that you actually took over?
Almost nothing. We had to dig the holes in the ground, we had individual holes, and they were primitive, but when you think of the number of men in this camp, as each unit came in, they were responsible for their own sanitation, which was a good thing, because otherwise you find that if men are not responsible for their own feeding, sanitation, anything, they tend to things tend to go wrong. So if you make it their own responsibility, they have no one to grumble to or about. We did very little training there. I was a teeny bit disappointed. I thought we would have done more. And in fact, for the first week while the administration was being carried out, the chaps were allowed to go into Rouen as often as they wished. It was a good distance. There was no transport. It was they had to walk a matter of 3-4 miles each way, and so it did deter some people, but when they got there, we were so fortunate, and this is the thing that people nowadays find it hard to credit. We got 180 francs to the pound. This is very, very difficult to grasp now. We were a rich country, and so although our men weren't being paid very well, at 180 francs to the pound, for instance, champagne used to cost me 3 shillings a bottle. And instead of having the dreadful tea that they brought in round in the morning, Vane and I had a pint of champagne each for gunfire.
How were the men meeting the French and getting on with them? They were now meeting them, of course.
Straight away, the English soldier is an incredible person. You may put him down wherever you like in the world, and you will find that he's established friendly relations in a matter of hours. It's quite astounding to me. Even to this day, I wonder how they did it. They could talk, the boys who'd never who'd never been out of the home villages were chattering away, and I was puzzled. I still don't understand how it happened. However, this did happen, and we had very little trouble. In fact, the only troubles we had, there was a camp, part of the camp had Scottish people in it, Scottish troops, and they were nice chaps until they'd had a drink. Rather distressing.
And this led to conflict between
the
two.
There's occasionally conflict. I was lucky in that the Sergeant Major we had in charge of our party, Miles Etherington, you may have heard of him, he was killed in Kohima. He was a regular soldier with about 16 years service, strong, physically fit, trained to the last. He knew everything about infantry training and tactics. It was a joy and a pleasure to have him. And I remember, in fact, one night coming back from, walking back from Rouen, a drunken Scot took hold of my shoulder and said, "Ah, my old friend McGonagall." And the Sergeant Major moved between us and said, "It isn't your old friend McGonagall." And this man took the hint. That's the sort of fellow he was. We used to go up to the Big Hotel next to the cathedral and have a bath up there rather than the primitive arrangements that there were, and have tea there because, as I say, at 180 francs to the pound, we were pretty well off. This training and lack of training went on for a while. We kept asking, when are we going, when we're going to our battalions, when will we be moving? This is ridiculous, the men are getting stale, as they were. You can't help it. You can picture an enormous camp, because although there were we extra 3,000 moved in, I would say there were already another 3,000 there then. So there was a lot of troops, and it was spread over an enormous and it's still, incidentally, it still is a military training ground.
It must have been a problem keeping the men occupied.
Oh, it was.
How did you do it?
I made them, I tied them with route marches. I kept them fit that way. The Sergeant Major kept them fit with PT, and we did rifle training, bayonet training. Oh, we did all sorts of. The facilities weren't available really to do what we wanted.
Were you concerned about the standard of readiness of the soldiers? Obviously, thinking in terms that at any moment you may be called into action.
The men were longing to get to be able to fight. The English soldier doesn't see any sense in hanging about. He likes to get on with the job and get it over and get back. And he can't understand hanging about. We found this eventually, later on the withdrawal. They used to be, I had to hammer them to make them withdraw when we were obviously in danger of being encircled. They had to be driven back. They wanted to go ahead. They get the blood gets up and the way they want to go forward. Anyhow, about, I think the men, found, you see, cigarettes and everything else were handed out for them, and there wasn't any strong beer, so they didn't get as troublesome as they often would do. They didn't all go up to town even. Once they'd been up to Rouen and seen it, it was still bright lights, there were still shows. The cafe we used to go to had a women's band, and whenever we came in, because my friend was part Belgium and so on, they used, for some reason, used to play him Roses in Picardy, which seemed to please him. But that's the sort of atmosphere. It was unreal.
What was the food situation like in the camp?
Average. You couldn't say it was bad, you couldn't say it was good. It was just the sort of thing you would get in a camp of that size. They were doing the best.
It was run by English personnel?
Oh yes, it was run by, that's right, the army cooks cooked everything. Most of it were army rations brought over from England. You know, the old McConaughey stew and all the rest of it, all in. Oh, this sort of thing pursues English soldier wherever he lives. Anyhow, there is little to say about that. It was disappointing that we didn't get forward in time, because when the Germans made the first attack, my friend and I were up at the hotel having a bath, and it was very embarrassing to hear these bombs dropping, and the hotel did shudder, and sitting in the bath you feel a little bit naked. And so we had to scamper out and hurry back to the camp, where no bombs had been dropped. But that was the beginning, when early in May, we'd wasted a whole month in this camp, waiting while the admin was sorted out. I think that what had been happening was that higher up had been trying to persuade the Belgians to let us move forward into positions. They were afraid to upset the Germans, and so they hovered. We had these beautiful positions, the BAF had these beautiful positions prepared, and of course when the balloon went up, the Belgian king said, "Oh, please come and help." So all these lovely positions were left, and our troops had to move forward into strange country.
When the Germans attacked, in effect, and this bombing was taking place, you must have known then that things were going to happen, something was going to happen.
Oh yes, we knew straight away, because thanks to the press report the second anything happens everywhere, military or otherwise, and so this was round the camp immediately that we'd be going straight away. We didn't. We got prepared, we stood to, we stood down, we stood to, we stood down. Eventually, I got word for a draft of, it was the 90 men, because that was the 90 men I had with me. I had a draft of 90 men to take forward to the brigade, and I would be met at the brigade.
This was 151 Brigade.
This was 151 Brigade. So we entrained, moved off. We moved so far. Now, I'm not going to say how far now. We would be probably about halfway, and by that time the rails were being bombed by the Germans, trains were being machine gunned from the air, and so the French rail people decided that it would be no good going further. So we detrained and we started marching up. But of course, the hordes and hordes of poor refugees were pouring down the roads, an absolute nightmare. And they occupied the full road, so our troops couldn't march up the road, and I had to have them in even the ditches and in the fields on each side. Terribly tiring, very, very hard to keep a force together when you have to literally scramble up the road.
How did you move? Was it single file or within the ranks?
At night, in the dark, when these people weren't moving, we got into threes and we marched as fast as we could. As soon as daylight came, we had to... Well, actually, I let the chaps sleep part of the time when we could find cover, you know, wood or something. And then when we marched, it was in single file on each side of the road. Awfully difficult. And
there's no danger of you losing the other group on the other side of the road with all these civilians in between.
Every danger. That was the trouble. This was a tiring thing. And this is why I was so fortunate to have Vane with me. He and I had a system. You remember, the infantry officer has a whistle, and we had a simple whistles to say too far ahead and so on. So we kept them together. But it was frightful, the poor people. And the Germans deliberately machine gunned them.